Pushkin.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is.
It's hard to mistake James Taylor's voice. It's sweet and sounds carefree. And if you know the Cliff Notes version of James's life, that kind of makes sense. Summers in Martha's Vineyard as a kid, signed by the Beatles to Apple Records at only 19 years old, relationships with Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon, becoming one of the premier singer-songwriters of the 70s when competition was stiff. But these autobiographical details and his sweet voice belie the dramatic events of his early days. Two stints in a mental institution, heroin addiction, an alcoholic father, this is the life James attempts to make sense of in his new audio memoir, Breakshot, all of which he traces back to a traumatic family event he says left the Taylors cursed. When Malcolm Gladwell and James Taylor got together to talk about his new memoir, they dove into these darker memories from James's past and how his songwriting started as a form of therapy. They also discuss why James feels his last five albums have been his absolute best work, including his latest, American Standard, which features this version of God Bless the Child that you're hearing.
Mama may have, Papa may have.
His new album's out February 28th, and it's full of the songs James heard growing up. Songs that offered him refuge, songs that ultimately offered him a new life through music. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Malcolm Gladwell and James Taylor from GSI Studios in New York.
But wait, I wanted to start with the most unexpected fact that came up as I was preparing, which was Taylor Swift is named for you.
Yes, that was a surprise to me too. We first met at a benefit for an organization that is meant to mitigate teenage pregnancy. And and she was doing a couple of songs, and so was I.
Yeah.
And she told me at that point, that was before she, you know, was such a success. But
yeah. Makes me wonder how many Taylors out there have you inadvertently spawned?
It's a good question.
I was listening to Breakshot, your Audible original, which I thought was fascinating. So your dad grows up in
Morganton, North Carolina,
and your mom is a New Englander. I kind of put a real, you're saying, grew up as a fisherman's daughter in Newburyport, so a real New Englander.
That's right.
Your parents married in what year?
They married in 1944. Well, probably in 1947.
Yeah. 47, yeah. So in 1947, that would be right. They would have. That's what I mean. One, your father a Southerner, your mother a New Englander. Those are distinct identities in that.
They are. They are. I mean, they were politically very aligned, but they were from two different cultures. But my father was, you know, the thing is really about him is that he didn't belong, you know. I think that he didn't really, he identified sort of as we identify our context, he identified that as being Southern, but I don't think he felt a part of anything really. I think he was quite isolated. It's sort of, I think that's the key to understanding my father is that, that he was, he never really had a context in which he felt he belonged. And, you know, that changed over time, but.
I'm pursuing this both because this is a big part of Breakshot, this memoir that you've done, but also because it so obviously feeds into a lot of your music. But I wanted to sort of linger a little bit about you tell this story. Can you tell the story in the book? It's one of the most heartbreaking stories I think I've ever heard about your grandfather.
I think it's my great grandfather.
That's right, your great grandfather.
You mean the one who delivered my father?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my grandmother biologically was a woman from Springfield named Theodosia Haynes, and she met Alexander Taylor, my grandfather, and the two of them fell in love, and she got pregnant. They married, and the child was delivered by my grandfather's father, my great-grandfather. And he hadn't delivered a child for a while, and I think after the birth of my father, she contracted what was called childbirth fever, but it was really just an infection, you know, just a... This was pre-antibiotics, and she died. And the great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, who delivered her, was dead within 2 months. And I think the assumption is that he may have suicided, you know. So so my father, really, like his mother, went to the family, because my grandfather Alexander just fell apart, really, and descended into alcoholism, which was, there was a lot of addiction in the family. Yes, it was a tragic start, and I think it gave my father the sense that his position was very conditional, you know, that he didn't really have a secure place in the world, and that his performance was going to really, you know, that was going to be the thing that allowed him, you know, a place in the lifeboat.
In Breakshot, you talk about a lot about how that's almost like the original sin of the Taylors, that it casts a shadow, a multi-generational shadow in the family.
It does. It's like ripples, and they spread out. And I think the thing manifested when my dad, you know, he had five kids in 6 years. And we all, as we entered adolescence and the prospect of leaving home, I think that my dad just was out of his depth. I think it was something that he just didn't know how to deal with. It also coincided with his drinking becoming, you know, alcoholism progresses. My father is extremely functional alcoholic for many, many years. But ultimately that, you know, that you lose control of that eventually. And that happened around the same time. So my parents' marriage also fell apart at that time. And the culture was the Vietnam baby boom culture of 1968 or 66. You know, everybody was questioning their connections and their context, and the thought was abroad in the land that we'd change everything, you know, that it would all, that there was a distinct interruption, you know, discontinuation with the World War II mentality of that generation, and we were a new generation that was really going to change things. And there were so many of us at the same time. So, you know, all of these things happened at once. My own personal story is that I sort of had a breakdown. You know, I just couldn't go forward. And I sort of had a crisis there. And it precipitated in my siblings a similar sort of derailment. And
how many of your siblings end up institutionalized?
Two of them.
Two others.
But my older brother really should have, he was the, ultimately the sacrifice, my brother Alex.
Yeah. So you spend 10 months at McLean Hospital. And once again, we're, as you point out, McLean Hospital is where Robert Lowell went, where Anne Sexton was teaching poetry classes, you said at some point. Sylvia Plath worked there.
Yes.
I mean, the list is kind of like, it's a kind of another, you know, there's a series of these kind of sort of iconic set pieces.
Right, it's like a nexus. Yeah, it's true. I didn't think about it at the time, but it sort of was where one went, you know, if you had a breakdown.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, you know, it was Harvard Medical School and Mass General Hospital.
Yeah. I was curious about in those, so you had this very tumultuous late teenage years where you leave North Carolina, you go to boarding school for a while, then you have your breakdown, you go back to North Carolina, then you finish school at Milton Academy. Were you writing music in that period? What was your musical identity in those years?
Yeah, I was starting to. Well, when I went home to North Carolina for that junior year, I was in a band with my brother Alex. But before then, on Martha's Vineyard, had been the middle of what a friend of mine calls the folk scare of the early 60s, you know. So folk music was the sort of thing on campuses, and it was, you know, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and, you know, that, but also Odetta and Lightnin' Hopkins and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Jesse Lone Cat Fuller and Reverend Gary Davis. You know, there was country blues in there as well. So on Martha's Vineyard in the summertime, it was easy to pick up a guitar and learn from other people who were around and to find people to sing with and play with. And there were open mics at a various, a couple of coffee houses, they were called.
But what's the function of, am I reading too much into it? Does music have a kind of psychological function for you in that sort of troubled moment? Is it your own personal therapy as you deal with all of this?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think that probably a good deal of what art is, if this can be called art, it's a commercial art, is a kind of therapy or a way of getting something insoluble that's inside, just in front of you somehow, you know. It's like, you know, I was a cutter when I was a teenager. And it's almost like that. You sort of want to see the scar. So music definitely started to me to, you know, it was always a celebratory thing. That was the main thing about it, is that it was fun and joyful. But when I started to write, from a sort of a therapeutic place, mm-hmm. I guess. And that's what I'm known for, sort of that kind of, I mean, people who go into my stuff in any depth realize that that's just a corner of it, but it was the thing that really resonated with people when Fire and Rain took off.
Yeah. I guess my question, and this is an unanswerable question, but a fun one and nonetheless, had your mother, Trudy, married a prosperous, happy New England merchant, and had that been the version of your life, are you a musician or are you something else?
No, I mean, there was no, my mother had studied voice. She sort of was the last generation that went to finishing schools. And she went to a school in Boston called Mrs. Child's School on Beacon Hill. And those women were learning to be wives. It was sort of pre-Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know. Mm-hmm. It was my mother could see the promised land, but she, you know, and was frustrated, and, you know, so she had children and was basically a sort of a faculty wife, which was a job, really. But when I, you know, so in the summertime, I'd been playing the guitar and getting into blues and folk music. I met my friend Danny Korchmar, who was to be for my whole life a major connection for me musically. And he introduced me to a lot of the music that I was, has been a source to me. So there was this musical life on the vineyard. Then when I went home to North Carolina, I was in a band with my brother Alex, and I played the electric guitar, and we basically were, we played fraternity parties, we played...
What were you playing? What kind of music?
Well, it was called beach music. And what it was the music that Southern college students loved when they went to Virginia Beach or Myrtle Beach or or Wrightsville Beach when they took their spring break and they went to party on the coast. That was the music.
So what kind of, can you remember any of the songs? I've never heard that term before.
A song like Shotgun by Junior Walker and the All-Stars. That's beach music.
Yeah.
It was very close to the Chitlin circuit.
Oh, you know? I see.
Those acts that could work that circuit could also do the beach circuit. It was a place where races mixed to a certain extent, a limited extent. And that's what my brother Alex got into. You know, he just loved that music. Anyone who heard it loved it. You know, it was great. Like, you know, that song, A Searching by the Coasters. Gonna find her. I'm gonna find her. I'm gonna find her. I'm gonna find her. Well, if I have to swim a river, well, you know I will. And if I have to climb a mountain, you know I will. And if she's hiding up on a blueberry hill, am I gonna find that girl? You know I will. Yes, I'm gonna find her. Yeah, that was a song called Searching, and it was the first soul music that I ever heard. I was in a bus going from a camp in the mountains of North Carolina to Tennessee over the border, and the bus driver had I don't know if it was the car radio or if it was a transistor or what it was, but it was playing that song, and it was like somebody, you know, carbonated my blood. You know, it was just amazing. Yeah.
Was it unusual for white people to be playing that music in that part of North Carolina at that point? I mean, was your band with your brother an oddity, or was it commonplace?
Well, there was only one among high school students in our town. Mm-hmm. So in the town of Chapel Hill. And for that reason, we got work. We weren't very good, but we were, you know. So that was a big influence. Folk music first, then beach music, my brother's music. And then after McLean, I came to New York and started playing here in town for about a year. We had a band called The Flying Machine. And we just couldn't compete. We petered out. You had to get a record contract in those days, and we did sign one. Much to my chagrin, years later, when it turned out I'd also signed a publishing contract, but we were in their hands, and they gave us 2 days in the studio, and that's it. You know,
what kind of music was that?
You know, it was funny. It started by, we sort of identified as a blues band, but you know, we realized that was sort of inappropriate. We were essentially suburban kids, you know. Mm-hmm. But we loved the music. But we also played Hoagie Carmichael songs. We played God Bless the Child, the Billie Holiday tune. Uh-huh. And so we had odd material, you know. And I wrote a couple of songs for that. I wrote a tune called Night Owl. I'm a Night Owl. And I wrote a song called Brighten Your Night with My Day. I cringe to think of it, but there it is. You know, we tried our best. We got a job as the house band at a club called the Night Owl at McDougal and Third.
That's so the heart of the village, yeah.
Just down to, yeah.
But this is a little bit after Dylan's gone.
Dylan has left, and Stephen Stills had gone to the coast and started Buffalo Springfield. That was also, you know, that was an example of what we were aspiring to. But our record deal was a dead end, and it basically killed us. We were signed to people who wouldn't record us. So
yeah,
that was the end of the band.
Is there anything that you wrote in those years that you feel like stands with some of your best work? Do you look back fondly on anything from that and say, you know what, that was really the beginning of what I really stand for?
You know, I wrote a song called I'm a Night Owl that I think was the best thing I wrote in those days, just as a song, the way it was constructed. Mm-hmm. And you know, and it had a feel to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it was good. And I've often thought that I'd like to, you know, try to cut that.
Yeah.
Recut it.
How did it go?
Oh, it was, you know, a fish likes the water. That's where he's going to be. A monkey lives on fruits and bananas, so he lives in the top of a tree. But my eyes are made for darkness, so the nighttime's right for me. I'm a night owl. Most folks like the daytime. They like to see the shining sun. They're up in the morning, often run until they're too tired to have any fun. But when the sun goes down and the bright lights shine, my daytime has just begun. I'm a night owl. Close those curtains for me, honey. It's just about to make me blind. Anyway.
Wait, can I just point out that you are reciting from memory a song written over 50 years ago, and you must have written in the course of your life how many songs? How many?
I think it's probably approaching 150 now. Maybe it's more. Maybe it's more like 200 now. Yeah. But
it's pretty impressive.
You know, it's a funny thing. I think that for me, anything that has music connected to it, I can remember. I don't know any Italian, but I can sing La Donna Mobile because, you know, I learned it in Italian. And it's just because there's music attached to it, it sticks in my mind.
Yeah.
In fact, I think that that's why people, when they learn English, why English songs, English popular music is so useful to them, you know, that a lot of people have told me, you know, I learned English by listening to English lyrics.
Yeah. Who, but to go back to, so we're talking about what years now that you are, what year are you in? Are you in Greenwich Village playing in those clubs?
Well, that's 1966.
66.
I'm 18 years old.
You're 18 years old. When you look back on that year, I know you fall back into drugs, or fall into drugs, I guess, for the first time. But is the year in your memory chaotic? Is it a pleasant memory? I mean, how do you kind of look back on that?
Oh, it was great. You know, the whole thing was, it was a riot. You know, I was free. 18 and living in New York City. The drinking age was 18 at that point. So
where were you living?
We lived in the Albert Hotel, which was at on University at 11th Street. It was below Union Square. Mm-hmm. And there was one of the floors of the hotel had burned. You know, there'd been a serious fire, but there was one room that had survived it, but they couldn't rent it, but they rented it to me and the bass player, my best friend, Zach Wiesner, who I knew from the Vineyard. Zach and I took that sort of a suite of rooms for almost no money. I mean, we rehearsed in the basement of the Albert Hotel. So that was where I lived first. And then I would crash at different people's places too. And eventually I got an apartment on 84th and Columbus, which in those days was
rough.
You know, it was, yeah, it was a rough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it was, it was a cheap rent.
What are you doing all, it's a weird question, but what are you doing all day at that age in New York City?
Well, you get up late and you go to work at the Night Owl Cafe, which is where our gig was. And that was 6 days a week. So
from when to when?
Probably from 7 o'clock till midnight.
Yeah.
3, 4, 5 sets we would do. People would come in, they'd order a hamburger and a cup of coffee or something. They didn't have a liquor license. And, you know, we'd play a 20-minute set, and there was no backstage to speak of. There was like a closet where we could hang out, or in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But,
Are you writing? How much music are you writing in those years?
I'm starting to write now, but
like that Night Owl song is written in that era.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the guy who ran the club, it's a labor of love. I don't know why he did it. He did it because he loved the music, I think, and just wanted to be part of the life, because it, you know, it wasn't a living for the guy. We were making like less than $100 a week for each of us. But you could live on that then.
Yeah.
It's amazing that you could live on that. But, you know, the subway still wasn't a quarter. It was still a dime to ride the subway.
So $100 could go a certain distance.
Yeah,
sure. In those days.
And, you know, they also fed us dinner. I mean, free hamburgers at the Night Owl. So really, rent was the only consideration.
So things get bad, and then your father comes and rescues you, which was an incredibly touching moment, given how troubled your relationship was with him and how troubled your family life was. He drives from North Carolina to New York.
He did. I called home. The flying machine had disbanded. You know, I had a heroin addiction that it really was going to get me in trouble sometime very soon, you know, because I no longer was in contact with Joel O'Brien, who was had been my sort of source and a sort of safe way to get into to get access to the drug. But being an 18-year-old kid on the street trying to hustle enough to have a habit was going to really get me in trouble soon. There's no question about it. And my father really did. It was like the cavalry coming over the hill.
Mm-hmm.
I think he sensed it. I called him up. He said, "How you doing?" I said, "You know, Dad, not so good." And he just said, "Where are you?" I told him the address. 84th and Columbus. He said, "Don't move." He said, "Stay right there. Do not leave the apartment." So, you know, I went home to North Carolina, and I stayed there for about 6 months, and then I went to England.
Yeah. And you serendipitously get in touch with someone who is involved with Apple Records.
That's right. You see, my friend Cooch, Danny Korchmar, who had been the other guitar in the Flying Machine, and who I'd known from Martha's Vineyard, and we'd played. He had, you know, introduced me to the blues and some Latin music and stuff. And he had, in the year before the Flying Machine, he had been with a group called the King Bees, much better name. And the King Bees had backed up Peter and Gordon, an English group, a duo. I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. That was one of their hits. And another McCartney song called Knight in Rusty Armor. But Peter was Jane Asher's sister, who was Paul McCartney's girlfriend, you know, sort of steady girl for a while there. And Peter had, as chance would have it, he had just accepted a job at the Beatles' brand new record label, Apple Records. And his job was basically to find and sign other acts to the label. So when I called Cooch, when I got to London and really started getting serious about somebody hearing my music and maybe making a record, I called Cooch back in the States and said, "Have you still got a number for Peter Asher from Peter and Gordon?" And he said, "I got a number. I don't know if it's any good," but it turned out it was. And Peter was just at the right person to call at the right time. He heard my stuff and liked it. And he took me to Apple Records, where I auditioned for Paul McCartney and George Harrison. And they said, "Peter, if you want to make a record with this guy. Let's sign him.
How old are you at this point?
At this point, I'm 19.
You're 19 years old. You have just had this kind of disastrous ending to your time in New York. And then within 6 months or a year, you are auditioning for Paul McCartney and George Harrison.
And an incredible, just the mother of all lucky breaks, you know, just exactly what you...
Wait, so how did it happen? You go over to your where is it again? Where is the Apple Studios? It's in...
Eventually they were in Savile Row. But when I went there in early January of 1968, they were at Baker Street.
Yeah.
It was a sort of rented office space. And as soon as they bought a building in Savile Row, that's where they moved. But I just couldn't believe it. I went along with Peter and we went up into these offices and I met a number of people who seemed really nice. And it was all, you know, quite amazing. And Peter remembers it as leaning out into the hall and just saying, "Is there a beetle in the house?" And
there was.
And there was. There were two.
Two.
And they came down and we walked into a room and I can't remember it really very well.
What did you play?
I played Something in the Way She Moves.
And why did you choose? That was, at the moment, that was you considered to be your best song.
Yes. I thought it was probably... It's probably the best one I had. If I've been well, you can tell she's been with me now. She's been with me now quite a long time. Yes, and I feel fine.
We'll be back with more of James Taylor's Beatle Audition after the break. We're back with Malcolm and James Taylor. Before the break, James was telling Malcolm about his audition with Paul McCartney and George Harrison and producer Peter Asher, where he played the group Something in the Way She Moves.
Wait, so they listen and they say, do you remember?
They said to Peter, you know, I think Peter went out of the room with them. They said, very nice, very nice, and left the room. And Peter said, well, what do you think? And he said, sounds good to me. Do you want to record him? Peter said, yeah, I'll produce him. And they said, okay, yeah. Simple as that.
One of the great job interviews of all time, can I point out?
I think so. You know,
it's like a fantasy of a job interview.
Yeah, an actual, you know, Apple only lasted for a very short time, less than a year, really.
Yeah.
Because Alan Klein had convinced Yoko and John that he should manage them, because after Epstein died, there really was a great gap. Mm-hmm. And no question about it. Apple was badly run and it was hemorrhaging money. But, you know, there were a number of people signed to it. Billy Preston, myself, Mary Hopkin, Jackie Lomax, the Modern Jazz Quartet. But Alan Klein came in and wasn't interested in any of that, you know. And our contract said that we could audit him. He didn't want to be audited. So, you know, McCartney didn't, you know, had been warned off him by a number of people, including the Rolling Stones, who had a disastrous time with Alan Klein. But he was just one of these pirates who manages to convince people. And John and Yoko went for it. So it was probably like the death knell for the Beatles, but he closed down Apple and Peter, I had left London to go back to the States, and I was trying to clean up. I was trying to shake my habit again. And Peter called up while I was in a institution back in the Berkshires, actually, where I live now. And he said, "Well, this place is finished," he said, "and we're out of the contract because Alan Klein will not be audited." So
that was it.
He said, "I'm going to move." He said, "I'm moving to Los Angeles. And what do you say? I find us a record company and I'll be your manager."
Yeah.
And I said, "Sounds good." And I called Paul McCartney and asked him if he thought Peter would be a good manager. And Paul said, "Yeah, I do. I think he'd be
good." Had Paul McCartney's number?
I guess I did. Maybe Peter gave it to me, you know?
Yeah. Maybe. Can I say your charmed life? Your life is both not charmed and insanely charmed.
Oh, it's totally charmed.
Yeah. All right.
And it's been, all, you know, the only parts about it that are bad are totally my fault. I mean, just because I have this mangled eye that sees everything, you know, as being a drag. But in fact, it's just been a gift from start to finish. It's been wonderful.
Yeah. There's a little stray detail that confused me because your song was called Something in the Way She Moved.
Yes. Something in the Way She Moves, yeah.
Something in the Way She Moves. So George Harrison, does he write his song after hearing yours?
Yeah.
Does he own up? Does he say he was inspired by it?
No, I don't think he really remembered my song. I think he remembered the line, "There's something in the way she moves."
Yeah.
And he liked that line. But I don't think he really, it was some months later.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, that the Beatles song, let's see. "But my baby buys me things, you know. She buys me diamond rings, you know. She said so. Da 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 da. She's in love with me, and I feel fine." I took that from the.
Oh, I see. So it's all karma.
Yeah, it's all just goes around. And yeah. And I looked at it as a real, you know, the thought that I might have inspired a George Harrison song was enough for me. That was great.
Yeah, yeah. And in Breakshot, you're fast forwarding about the strange set of coincidences that surround the death of John Lennon. And I was so, I mean, the whole thing is just so, you couldn't make this up. So
you could make Trump up, for Christ's sake.
Well, you know? Yes, couldn't make. There are many things in our world now, but you're at that point living just a few blocks from John Lennon on Central Park West, I'm assuming.
No, not a few blocks. I was living one street up. My window on the sixth floor of apartment 6S at the Langham, which is the building uptown from the Dakota, that looked out on 73rd Street and the back of the Dakota with a sort of an arch that gave way into the archway. Didn't reach all the way to street level, but it was an archway into the courtyard of the Dakota. So when John was shot, I was in the window, you know, just talking to someone on the phone, and I heard the shots, you know. And then
the day before, you would run into this strange character on the subway.
Yeah. You know, just this sort of sweaty, obviously either coked up or on speed or on some combination or in a manic break or something. This guy had sort of fastened onto me as we both left the subway station at 72nd Street, which is right there at the Dakota. And I was walking up one block to my door, And he just was in my face talking to me about this and that and John Lennon this and you know his music and he has plans for this and he wants to do that. And I just, like, you know, the guy was, face was glistening with sweat, you know. It was just you know, the picture of someone who was manic, you know, and just flying. And I just, you know, scraped him off and got out of there.
And it was Mark David Chapman.
Yeah, it was.
Wow.
Couldn't believe it. The next day, I was talking to Peter Asher's wife out on the West Coast. And she said, I don't know if it was the Manson trials or if maybe one of the Manson crew had tried to shoot President Ford or something like that, but
Squeaky Fromm.
Yeah. Anyway, she said things are crazy out here on the West Coast. You know, it just feels so strange in Los Angeles. You know, the Manson stuff coming up and stuff. And I said, you think it's strange there? I just heard the police shoot somebody on the street. You know, and she said, well, how do you know that? I said, well, it sounded like a 38. It was five shots in a row, which is, you know, the police, I've been told that that's what a police shooting is, that they empty the gun and that they keep an empty chamber under the hammer. And so I was sure that it was a police shooting. And she said, wow. And we said goodbye and hung up and rung off. And like 20 minutes later, she called me back and said, that wasn't a police shooting. That was John Lennon.
Oh.
Just a half hour later or something.
Yeah.
You know, just amazing. They had already heard about it, but, you know. I had visited Yoko and John at the Dakota at one point, and I think they invited me over because they wanted, Allen Ginsberg wanted to talk to me about some songs that he had written, and he was there. But, you know, I didn't know what to make of his lyrics or mm-hmm. and I really wasn't interested in collaborating, you know, and I just, it was a beautiful, you know, an oddly decorated, but, you know, by what standards, I don't know. But it was, you know, it was amazing to be in their apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been in other apartments in that building before. I'd looked at Leonard Bernstein's apartment, which was on the market, and my wife and I were looking for a place then, but you know, it was out of our league. So that's the only time I visited them there.
Mm-hmm.
But I was perched in my window when the shots rang out.
I wanted to touch on a couple of other things about about songwriting. I would be remiss, you know, here I am a few feet from one of the great songwriters of the last.
You're kind of say that thing.
So I feel I have to. One of the things I read that fascinated me was that you often begin to compose on the piano and then go, because we always imagine people like yourself in the room with your guitar strumming away. But when did you start doing that? And what's the advantage of doing it that way?
On the piano?
Yeah.
Well, it's just a slightly different, you know, it's often the case that you'll sit down and you'll be playing like a little, you know, change that comes to mind. That will suggest to you a sort of a lyric or,
mm-hmm.
Let's see. And likewise, if you, a sort of scrap of melody and a little bit of lyric will happen in the context of those little wheels that you're playing, and that will you know, sort of ignite a song. Mm-hmm. And that can also happen when you're sitting at the piano, like, you know, just, I can't claim to play the piano at all, but I've written a number of songs on the piano, and then I sort of explain them to a piano player, and let go of it, you know, and he'll change the key. I can only play in C. I'm a bit rusty even at that, but that's a tune called Shed a Little Light, written on the occasion of Martin Luther King's birthday. And
that was Shed a Little Light.
Shed a Little Light.
So I'm just curious about, what is it you're hearing on the piano that you can't hear on the guitar or can't do on the guitar enough?
No, it really is what I can manage to do with my fingers and the sound that it makes that comes back to me. It's a feedback thing. And, you know, suddenly I'm, you know, trying to construct a little melody on the piano that I like. You know, I'll record that. I'm always traveling with something. Well, now that our phones are these great recorders, I don't have to carry one anymore, but I used to always carry a little digital pocket recorder. And if I have an idea or a lyrical idea while I'm walking on the street or a melody comes to mind, I'll whistle it into the thing. And then I'll when it comes time to really get serious about working stuff, I'll look back through all of these things and find things to work on, things to elaborate on, or things that will fit together and make a piece. And so with the piano, it's really just sitting down at it and playing what occurs to me. But it's a combination of what, you know, it's always in the key of C. It's very prescribed. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's extremely limited. And so is the guitar, really. I mean, I'm not a chromatic, I'm not free up the neck with the guitar that, you know, I change capo position so that I can play in a different key, or so I can use A fingering up a whole step so it'll be in B, and that's more comfortable for some songs. So it's these limitations, really, that contain it. You know, I don't know what I'd do if I were absolutely chromatically free to do whatever I wanted. I'm really dependent upon my my limits, the limits of my vocabulary, musical vocabulary, the limits of my voice. You know, these things really put it into a shape and a recognizable one after a while. And you know, I think the same thing happens lyrically, that I keep going back to familiar topics like. I have a number of songs I've written about my dad, a couple about my mom. I have songs that are like hymnals, hymns for agnostics, spiritual songs that are looking for some kind of spiritual connection. I have love songs that I now write mostly to my wife. So then there's celebratory songs and occasionally a political song a little bit. But I keep coming back to the same, you know, it's almost like my limitations are really the containers that the juice gets poured into, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of Malcolm's conversation with James Taylor. We're back with more from James Taylor.
What song of yours do you think has been overlooked
there are a lot.
Can you pick one?
Never Die Young. It's Enough to Be on Your Way. If I Keep My Heart Out of Sight. God Have Mercy on the Frozen Man. The song There We Are. I believe that I've written my best work in the past five albums. And the album That's Why I'm Here. Hourglass, New Moonshine, October Road, and Before This World. I believe that I've written my best work, my best songs, and it just happens to be out of what people are familiar with for my work. And I think that I do have an audience that knows those songs, but they're not the money songs.
How does the act of songwriting change as you get older?
That's a really good question. It has less urgency to it, and you feel less like it's being extruded from you, like it's got to get out, you know, like scratch the surface anywhere and a song will come out. And it's more like the urgency leaves and it becomes more of a craft, and you become better at the process, you know. You develop a method, and you are more demanding in terms of the structure of it and the form of it.
There was a long gap between October Road and Before This World. What was happening in that period? Those are the two.
Yeah, you know,
those are your two last original songs of original music.
That's right.
2002 and 2015. Is that when?
That's
right. Yeah,
it may have been.
But wait.
2003 and 2014. But yeah.
Yeah, and Before This World was your first number one album.
Yes, it was. Yeah,
isn't it extraordinary?
Well. It is, although nowadays album sales are way off because people don't buy music really anymore in the same way.
Still, come on.
But it is, it's remarkable. And what it really means is the record company finally did their job, you know?
Yeah.
They finally, I don't have very good things to say about the record business, but I do think that it's better to have music exist in a commercial world than it is to have it to be dependent on the court, like some minor aristocrat in Germany somewhere to sponsor you, or the church. You know, those are the church, the court, and academia were the places where music used to happen, and the marketplace is better.
Yeah.
It's better. It's not great, but it's better.
Wait, so what, tell me what was happening in that gap. Were you giving up on songwriting?
No, not at all. I've just been extremely busy. I made two albums of cover songs, songs that because I have this great band that's like a musical community, and I wanted to record them. And I built a studio on my property, a big room, big wooden room, and we recorded a couple of covers albums, so that was in there. Also, a Christmas album was in there, which I always, as time goes by, your scruples kind of fall by the wayside, and I thought, but the Christmas album was a delight to make. And I made it with Dave Grusin, who's a great composer and arranger, and he produced it. And we just had a ball, so there were three albums that came out, and actually a fourth was the album from, I had a sort of theatrical piece that I did for a while, just myself and a piano player called a One Man Band. Mm-hmm. And we released that as an album as well. So there were four projects, three or four projects between those two albums. And we were recording a lot.
Yeah.
And then also you know, if you've got a family, if you have children and you're going to pay any attention to them, that's a big demand on your time. And also touring yeah. takes a lot of time too.
Yeah.
So really there was plenty going on.
Yeah. One last thing. And then I think we probably, will you play something just to bring our delightful chat to a graceful close? You're up to you, whatever you.
Well, I don't know if you know this song. Woody Guthrie wrote it. You know, he used to do commissioned songs. I think Roll On Columbia, Roll On, Your Power Is Turning Our Darkness to Dawn, Roll On Columbia, Roll On was for the power company that built the dam on the Columbia River. Yeah. So he would, you know, and he was hounded by someone that he knew who was belonged to an organization called the Ladies Auxiliary. And she wouldn't leave him alone. And finally he wrote, well, the Ladies Auxiliary is a fine auxiliary. It's the best auxiliary that you ever will see. If you need an auxiliary, make it the Ladies Auxiliary. It's the best auxiliary. I'll try it again without the mistake. Well, a Ladies Auxiliary is a fine auxiliary. It's the best auxiliary that you ever will see. If you need an auxiliary, the Ladies Auxiliary. It's the best auxiliary. And I guess that shut him up. No. There's your song.
Good. Thank you so much, James.
Thank
this
you,
has been
Malcolm.
An absolute delight.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to James Taylor for coming on Broken Record. His new album, American Standard, is out February 28th. And his new audio memoir, Breakshot, is available on Audible now. You can hear some of James's music on a playlist we put together for this episode at brokenrecordpodcast.com. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mia Lobel, and Leah Rose for Pushkin Industries. The theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.